Well, thank you for inviting me to talk to you about money, capitalism, economics. I mean, you're all interested in looking at economics from various angles. So hopefully you'll benefit from this evening's talk. So I'll bring a cultural political economy approach. So I'll talk to you about what it means as well by reference. So instead of talking about too much on theory, financialization, I decide I should talk to you about my current research on central banks, because I'm sure those of you who've done macroeconomics and banking, central banks are important, and then they print the money, so they are immediately related to money. And then since the crisis, the role of central banks have changed in many ways, but also they become very central to the way financialized capitalism is working. When I say central, in financialized capitalism, money and finance are obviously important, and the price of money, which is interest rate, is basically fixed by the central banks. That's a monetary policy. And they've been doing that for quite some time. And by using various policies. So I'll talk about this changing role of central banks, which for me, the orthodox economics cannot find good sort of answers to, but themselves as well, they're changing. But it's also about how studying economics, especially in financialized capitalism, because one of the aspects of financialized capitalism is conjunctural changes. When I say conjunctural changes, I'm referring to periods of anything between 4 to 7 years. And then we seem to see those periods, conjunctures, where important things happen. When I say important things happen, for example, in the late 1990s, we had the dot-com bubble, which burst in 2002. So we seem to have these bubbles in financialized capitalism. Now, obviously, how do you explain that? I mean, we have in economics, the idea of business cycles. Probably you must have done in your macro economics. And then also there are longer quantitative periods of up to 50 years where innovation drives major changes. But we also have these now finance-driven cycles. And then recently, Bank for International Settlement started to look at economies by using the concept of financial cycles, by using real estate prices and also debt levels, household debt and private sector debt. So then when we talk about financial cycles, we're talking about the price of financial assets, which in finance it is about pricing of risk, which is interest rates. So central banks are very central to the formation of those prices since the crisis through their quantitative easing, which I'm sure you heard about. What I will do, I'll bring a cultural political economy approach. When I say cultural political economy approach, because now the central banks are increasingly a cultural phenomena. Cultural in the sense that the financial media, media in general, they represent central banks, not just as technocrats, but people who save euro, right? De Rigi saved the euro. So using those terms. Or Janet Yellen, everybody tries to understand what she meant when she said about the timing of increasing interest rates in the US. So they gain these almost superhero powers. So it is important to bring that superhero sort of identity in the way they are represented, technocrats. That's something new. I mean, we always had central bankers being powerful, especially in the United States, going back to Volcker. What they said influenced financial markets, the development of economy. But this time, it's not just the US, which is the biggest economy, but we have now in the UK, Carney, the central bank governor, in Europe, De Rigi, and in the US, Janet Yellen, but also in Japan as well. So we have seen these central bankers all together, you know, gaining this kind of cultural identity of of being technocrats who can save financial markets, who can save banking system. Obviously, economics have its own terms to describe these things, so they bail out the banks, or if you've done Minsky, in Minsky in economics, you will always have these credit cycles, and the central banks will come and save the banking system and restore order. So there's an endogenous conditions that create credit-driven bubbles in capitalism, and then the central banks technically intervene. So what I'll try this is that increasingly we will refer to central bankers in non-technical terms. They're becoming part of the culture. Now, economics have never been comfortable bringing other concepts from other social sciences to look at identities. But when you look at the history of, when you look at the financialization, we increasingly use terms to describe certain financial actors. For example, two major ones, hedge funds and private equity. Like before the crisis in Germany, private equity and hedge funds were described as locusts, you know, buying up German companies to asset strip. And then also the behavior of Porsche. Porsche, they wanted to buy Volkswagen by using hedge fund techniques, by using derivatives, short selling. Okay, so they had a fight with the hedge funds, but they used hedge fund techniques. Now, it is difficult to understand those processes in purely economic terms, because it's a behavior, it's a war. Of course, when you go to economics, they have their own terminology, but it is increasingly we see certain financial actors being referred to as locusts or hedge funds as bad speculators. But now increasingly central banks are having that kind of general culturally sort of formed identities, not just technocrats, but too much of an expectation about what they do. And that's why then we need to look at other social sciences where these things are being used. So that's my current work. It is not easy. I'm trying. So it's a draft. So maybe with your comments, I can improve that theoretical framework. Now, because you are interested in money, and central banks are the institutions who control the supply of money. They can print money, and they are independent. Yeah. So we have this since the 1970s. Well, especially in Germany, the tradition of Bundesbank being independent, so they can fight the inflation. So being independent from the politics have always been important. So how much money goes into the economy? So they control the money supply through, you know, various means. So what happened after the crisis? This is the general image. Now everybody looks at how much the balance sheet of central banks have grown. So we have a monetary phenomena. The monetary phenomena is exceptional increase in the size of the balance sheets of central banks. Now, obviously, Japan, with Abenomics, they distort this picture. Now, in Japan, the situation is, you know, 50% of GDP, the size of the central bank. Because you hear about, in discussing the crisis, banks too big to fail, yeah, by looking at their balance sheet. So we have now a new actor, the central bank. Their balance sheets are getting bigger. Now, when we say bigger, it is not normal, because if you look at this level in the UK and in the US, normally, given the GDP, the banking system, and all the rest of it, so you have like 5% of GDP, the size of the balance sheet of central bank. Because the balance sheet of the central bank is how much money is injected into the economy. A sudden jump in 2008, so it is more than doubled in the US and UK, because they printed money to save the banking system by buying, in two different countries, by buying different sorts of assets. But in the US, it was basically buying the securitized mortgages. So stuff shifted from the bank balance sheets to the central bank balance sheet, and the central bank printed money, yeah, and gave it to the financial system. So that's an injection of money to the financial system. But when they do it, they have an economic theory. I mean, some of it is to save the banks, but they saved the banks in 2008. But since 2008, yeah, it's still not going down. It is, in some cases, like in the UK, it has increased. In the US, 2013 increased again. And then currently, you hear people like, some people in the US, they think it should increase further. There should be more quantitative easing. Now, when they said that, they have an economic theory. The economic theory is when you inject money to the financial system, that money, so there's a, I'll talk about that in a moment. So there's a macroeconomic theory of injecting money means keeping the interest rates low, then firms will borrow and invest. So injection of money has an economic theory behind it. That money should go towards productive activities, making the cost of money cheap, so companies will borrow from banks and invest, because this is done to achieve economic growth. This is done to achieve increase in employment. Now, that is not happening. And that's why Draghi is becoming increasingly aggressive recently. So European Central Bank is now doing quantitative easing like the US did, because the economy is not growing. So there's a macroeconomic theory of how this printing money through quantitative easing and other, what they call unconventional policies, to make money cheap and increase economic activity. And also to create inflation. There isn't enough inflation, so you print money. And that's what they're trying to do in Japan, which is not happening. Okay? So the balance sheet of central banks increased. Now, obviously in Germany, people are skeptical about this. They say, oh, it's going to create lots of inflation. And we don't want that. So Bundesbank is not happy with what ECB is doing. But also some macroeconomists say, oh, this is going to create inflation. Let's not do it. Yeah. But then we don't have enough inflation at the moment in Europe, because the inflation 2% is normal. So Draghi is trying to bring inflation to 2%. So that is a fact. Yeah. We have money created by central banks to achieve economic growth. Right, so they are then important. Now, when you do academic research, you look at data, yeah, data about the GDP, data about the balance sheet. But when I do research on cultural political economy, I also read what the financial media says. That is important, because this is not the tabloid newspapers, Financial Times. This is a serious paper, yeah? Written by people who know central banks, who know banks. Yeah, so the Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, I'm sure in German as well. So this is serious stuff, because central bankers read these as well, yeah? To see how they interpret what data. They take it seriously. Now that's important. I mean, this is one of the early contributors to cultural economy, Nigel Thrift. He has an article on how now the media has become part of the financial reality. I mean, that's why we have more coverage of finance in Bloomberg. So if you turn your television on, CNBC, I'm sure there are lots of German channels as well. So we have more of finance covered. Not economics, finance. Of course, they cover economics as well, but finance is sexier. Yeah, stock market went up, euro went down. You know, there's a crisis in Brazil. So, and it is a fact. We cannot ignore that. Now, how do we take it in our analysis is another issue. But macroeconomics, economics in general, are not comfortable with using this kind of representation of economics. But it is important, this kind of commentary. So this is Philip Stevens. Now he's an interesting guy. I mean, in Financial Times, there are some writers who are taken seriously by the politicians, by the central bankers, by bankers. And these guys are very close to the financial circles. So he said in 2013, they are the new masters of the universe. Yeah? So they have this power. Now, this power is represented. This is representation in linguistic terms. Now, representation of economic identities, economic events, in my research, and the people who are like me, who do cultural economy, we take it seriously. I mean, you can go to the history of science as well. I mean, when you go to Newton describing the universe, he resorts to metaphors as well. So we have this, you know, use of metaphors, language for things that we are not very clear in history of science as well. So intellectual sort of thing. So it says at the moment, politicians cannot be trusted. Yeah, because they couldn't save the economies from going bankrupt, and the commercial bankers are crooks. Yeah, because we hear every day LIBOR scandal, even today in the US, a couple of people from Rabobank went to Deutsche Bank as well. You know, they fixed the and one of the CEOs, one of the reasons he had to leave because some people thought he was aware of some of these LIBOR fixing in Deutsche Bank. So at the moment, then central banks, so it's not the politicians, it is the central banks who drive the economic policy. Now that's important because then I'll discuss, then we have a problem of democracy. I mean, how do they know what they do is good for everyone? How do we know as citizens that they have this knowledge, this increase of balance sheet is going to create what they say is going to create? Yeah. Now that's a serious problem. But anyway, these guys are now our new superheroes. Now, I will use the term vigilante as well, because most of economics tend to use neutral terms, just like the physics, chemistry. But political economy is about looking at the politics in the economic sphere as well. So I take it seriously what kind of terms we use to describe things. And there's a history of things. I mean, the words we use are important about making sense of the world, but also in political intervention, what we want from economics. So this is sort of my attempt to repoliticize the role of these technocrats. For me, they're doing things without being accountable, and then without really their knowledge being validated. And then you see, so this is Pulitzer, this is, you know, in Germany, you can read it in German. It's the first time, yeah, people protest in front of a central bank. Well, I need to check this, maybe I'm wrong, but I haven't come across people protesting in front of central banks. This is in Frankfurt, European Central Bank. And in fact, one protester threw egg to de rigueur as well. So increasingly people associate what they do, and this is especially with the debate with Greece, because European Central Bank made a decision not to provide liquidity to the Greek banks, and situation in Greece has become very bad. So the Syriza government had to renegotiate the terms, but they played a big role in the negotiation. So this is. I mean, we cannot ignore this for democratic reasons, but also questioning the validity of the knowledge behind central bank policies. And there are also new things, like in Germany, Bundesbank, the head of Bundesbank, and then some people said the ECB's outright monetary transaction scheme, which ECB announced that if the governments needed money, like Spain or Greece, European Central Bank would buy their bonds, but if they agree to certain conditionality. So it's going to act like IMF within Europe. Now, was it in the ECB's mandate? And then some people thought it wasn't. So it went to the courts. So it went to the courts in Germany first, and the German constitutional court passed the ball to the, it says, oh, it's a European matter. So the European, but then they come to a conclusion. This is, yes, ECB exceeded its mandate. So for me, ECB took the law into its own hand. Of course, they got the backing of politicians. Okay? But then ECG said if ECB didn't do that, then euro would have disappeared. Now that's again something new. Is it legal what they do? Yeah. So the evidence there is, oh, it's not legal, but if they didn't do it, would have been in trouble. Now, we see this kind of thing in Vigilantes. Yeah. When you look at the superhero comics, police cannot do anything. The lawmakers, yeah, they are corrupt, like the bankers. So you have this guy, Vigilante, without any judicial right, save the world. So this is basically, that's it. That's just, as long as they save the world economy, they can behave outside law. Now, this is, you know, we have someone from the law here. Now, this is interesting, yeah? Because we are here, a gray area. But that's the whole literature, or the whole genre of vigilantes about this. So when you look at, for example, Spider-Man, that's what he says. I am not, you know, I'm saving, I'm doing something good. But there's a public there, so part of the public, think that no, they're not doing it good. They're harmful. And then this is Draghi because it was again blamed for acting politically, and it says no, this is a rules-based institution. We are not a political entity. We are technocrats. But this is now a contention. So when we look at the history of what's happened, I mean, it started in 2007, central banks, it always happens, it's not the first time. Central banks, when there's a financial crisis, banking crisis, they act as lender of last resort, you know, supply the liquidity in the banking system. But it's been now 8 years. So usually, lender of last resort role happens, and after a year, when we look at history of central banking, then things go back to normal, and then the central banks retreat from being lender of last resort. But then things got more complicated in euro. There's a eurozone crisis. For me, it was a banking crisis. So European Central Bank intervened to keep the banking system and the financial system afloat. And now we've seen the quantitative easing as a major tool of central banks to keep the interest rates low. So their role has changed from being a lender of last resort to generating growth and jobs by keeping interest rates low. And that's the quantitative easing. And then we've seen it start with the US, soon after UK, and Japan in 2013 followed, and now EU since January 2015, we have quantitative easing in the EU. And then China joined in as well. Chinese central bank is doing, you know, playing with the interest rates, quantitative easing. So it is a global, one of the articles I co-authored, I said central bank-led capitalism. So in a way, we have a financialized capitalism where it is led by central bank policies. And then in 2000, we had a period of central banks' policies and wishes converging, but then US started to diverge from other central banks on the economy, because they thought in 2013, US economy is doing better, unemployment rate came down, they are achieving growth. So Bernanke said US might increase the interest rates. Now we've been waiting since 2013. Yeah, waiting for Godot. Will the interest rates go up or not? Yeah. But even the mentioning of interest rates going up in August, in May 2013, send shockwaves in the global financial system. Yeah? it is called tapering. Because if the US interest rates go up, in a financialized capitalism, you have hedge funds, banks, pension funds, fund managers, they have to reallocate portfolios. They change and then the immediate impact was on the emerging economies because the money came back from emerging economies because those trading positions wouldn't make much profit. So we have seen up until 2013 low volatility but high uncertainty in global economy. So my hypothesis is now central banks in Minskyan term have become endogenous. They are the creator of instability rather than outsiders settling things down. So we have kind of centrally planned risk distribution. So the markets don't work, basically, because risk, the price of interest is not in the financial markets. It is decided by the central bank. And most financial players, they think similarly. And there are also unintended consequences of their decisions. So in a way, those macroeconomic models which the central banks had in mind about how the quantitative easing policies and other unconventional policies would work, it ignores a financialized capitalism because their models they don't have a sophisticated financial system, and it creates as a result unintended consequences. So we have then seen a new tool being used by central banks since 2013, which is called forward guidance. So this is linguistic skills of central bankers communicating with markets rather than using monetary policy. So forward guidance about, oh, we will increase interest rates if these things happen. But they are very careful how they communicate because Bernanke is... announcement of possible exit from quantitative easing had a significant impact on financial markets. So in 2013, the summer of 2013, in global financial markets was very a volatile, scary period. Right, so given all these things, so my sort of question is, how do we repoliticize central banking in this context? So first, methodological. So instead of like the mainstream economics thing, central banks are universal, timeless institutions. In a financialized capitalism, their roles, intentions are conjunctural. So we need to. So I'm not making claims here to come up with a new theory of central banking. So my aim here is I'm looking at central banks since 2007. Yeah, in that conjuncture. So my model is to understand and try to explain that central banking. And in that sense, you know, there's a French philosopher of science and a scientific thought, Michel Serres. So I draw on his view of what sciences can be, which is about studying specific things at specific time, rather than generalizing and universalizing. But then there are also other disciplines who look at central banks, which are primarily economic sociologists like Lebaron. He's been doing work on central bankers before the crisis. Lebaron looks at the social capital of central banks. So he looks at which schools they go to, what they study, and then says that's how the, you know, there's a community of central bankers, and they have career ambitions. So they're not just people, scientists, technocrats, detached from the social and political processes. They have their own careers to manage, and then that knowledge acquisition is socially influenced rather than scientifically learned, like an engineer. So he looks at, for example, the social properties of globalism. And what he's doing now, Lebaron, is he's looking at, for example, the members of the European Central Bank, because there are some people in the European Central Bank Monetary Policy Committee who are more inclined to use unconventional policies, and there are some who are not. So he's looking at their backgrounds, what schools they went to, and then try to explain through their social capital the kind of policies they defend. And then we have with Marcusen the study of central bankers, which is more a Weberian sociological analysis. It's independent central bankers. So do we have a science of central banking? Because they all believe in the same thing. They use the same macroeconomic theory. So all central bankers today in the world, they believe their job is to keep the inflation low, to control inflation. Now that's very specific to central banking. And then he says, then are we talking about apoliticization or autonomization of central bank or depoliticization? I think that there's an argument that are they technocrats, scientists, apolitical or depolitical? Yeah. So we need to understand the knowledge and their knowledge about the economic policy. And then Abu Lafia, he looked at increasingly how central banks use communicative skills to influence expectations. So this is typical macroeconomic, you know, managing expectations, how expectations influence wages and prices. So he looks at how it works. And then Adolf has done a very interesting empirical work. Try to understand what drives central bank. What they try to achieve. He finds that the career preferences are important in the choice of policy. So we have increasing body of work on central bankers driven by sociologists. Not just economists. And then there's a cultural economy literature. And the primary one is by Douglas Holmes. He's an anthropologist. He did ethnographic work. So he spent time with the US Central Bank, Federal Reserve. And then he looked at the communicative practices. So he uses more cultural economy, how now central bankers, instead of using printing money, they use communication to influence expectations, signaling things to manage the price levels, and how they invest in that kind of activity. So he gives a detailed analysis of how that practice works. And then you have other people like Brigitte Young. She's recently presented a paper looking at the distributive consequences, and myself and my colleagues, we looked at the political economy of, we look at the distributive consequences of central bank policy. So my approach, as I said, lies in the cultural economy literature. So people like Martin, Clark, Thrift and Tickle, and Hyven, he's written a book on financialization as a cultural phenomenon. He's a young academic from the US. It's a very good book. I advise you to look at it. So this quote is from his book. It says, financial ideas, understandings, metaphors, and modes invade the cultural sphere through everyday life and media, forming micro-level power structures. So we have these power structures built through financialization. I mean, it's about people thinking about what will happen to the interest rates. Will they go up or down? What will happen to the real estate prices? Yeah, if you are in Berlin, the price is going to go up, and people are scared that in Germany now, you know, the house prices are going up. In the US and UK, it's about the pensions. So it creates interesting micro-level power structures between households, individuals, and financial sector. And now we also use, in the past with my colleagues, look at financial innovation by using anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss as a bricolage, because financial innovation in mainstream finance is financial engineering, scientific activity. Whereas we said, this is bricolage, DIY. So it is not as, it is a different kind of rationality, but it is not scientific rationality. And then we looked at hedge funds as nomadic war machine. They are not speculators. They are not, as mainstream things, arbitrageurs. They are like Genghis Khan's military machine. They attack financial markets. So they deploy strategies. And then Graham Thompson, he looked at investment banking and then introduced the concept of partisan and artisan, because people blame bankers that they fix the exchange rates, the LIBOR rate, how do we change the culture of finance. So he introduces these concepts of partisan and artisan, introducing to the... Right, so there's the literature looking at finance from... So what I'll do now, I'll look at the representation of central bankers. That's what I'm trying to study. And that's where I'm not 100% comfortable myself. So I'm still thinking about how to make this argument stronger. So clearly, we see the representation of central bankers out of the crisis. It is in a cultural field now. It's not, you don't see this only on the economics pages. Yeah, you can see a major tabloid on the front page. Derrigi did this. Yeah, Bernanke said this. Yeah, Carney had done this. And interestingly, last week, first time in the UK, the Bank of England started a forum. And it's the first time in central bank history. So they are talking to public about how to create financial markets that serve society. Now that's an interesting development. I've been to one of them. There was a central bank guy who took notes of what we said. It is so central bank is now being more proactive to listen to people about building safe financial markets. That's a UK phenomenon. And that's that initiative. But it is how they want to represent themselves. They want to create fair financial markets. Because there's lots of cultural, political debate about how bankers, through their misbehavior, people don't trust financial markets. And you'll see, you know, Derrigi with Merkel at the back, you know, is his James Bond. Now, these are not, I mean, of course, I mean, you can say, well, that's what the journalists do, but these are becoming more common. And this is in Financial Times when Bernanke said he might increase the interest rates, the whole world collapses. Yeah. So the power And also druggy, gambling with our money, because we don't know what's going to happen with the quantum easing. So these are cultural representation of central bank activities. Now, you will never see scientists in Japan, the latest nuclear disaster, you didn't see scientists being represented like this. Yeah? And also, like, again, I took like one Financial Times. Superman had issues with kryptonite. For Ashels, it was his heel. With central bankers, is it communicating with markets? Yeah. And then there's a book written on central bankers, The Alchemist, by a journalist. And this is from his book, Mankind Had Given Them Incredible Power. These are not being, you know, funny or ironic. You know, they write it with half truth in it. And then the Financial Times, monetary stimulus and other ways of averting apocalypse. Yeah. So these quotes, you could get them from superhero comics. Yeah. Now, I think it's interesting. You know, I'm not saying that, you know, but I take it seriously. So this is also, this is the political economy, part of the cultural political economy. So when Bernanke talked, the stock markets in emerging economies, so that's Morgan Stanley's composite index for emerging economies. So this is in May, and this is July. So in 1 month, the emerging economy stock markets more or less collapsed. And then since then, they haven't recovered. That's why we're now talking about, oh, emerging economies are now going down the drain. Yeah, because they rely too much on the cheap money from quantum easing. But not just emerging economies, even, this is, again, 22nd of May, Draghi talk. And this is German government bond yields. It went from about 1.4 to about... now that's a major increase in interest rates. So that's basically cost of borrowing for German government. And the same thing happened in the US. Now, when these things happen in financialized capitalism, financial markets are three times of GDP. So imagine how fund managers, pension funds, banks react to this. This is unexpected. So they have to close positions, lose money, sell bonds, buy shares. So it has significant impact on financial markets, because the government bond yields are important, and these are big changes, from 2% to almost 3% is a big jump. So this is what Financial Times said when the yields went up. Draghi must act so the Eurozone is not a major casualty of US policy. Yeah? Save us, Draghi, save us. I mean, this is, and then a concert of carefully choreographed policy comments, so this is the communication, from People's Bank of China, the European Central Bank, and the Bank of England have helped normalize market liquidity expectations after the recent stampede out of risk. This is happening in the summer of 2013. Now, we don't know what they talk. Yeah, it's a democratic issue. So there are consequences of this. Now, so there's one form of representation of central bankers as these superhero figures. But there's also central banks representing themselves. Draghi famously said in July 2013, he will do whatever it takes to preserve the euro. Yeah. Carney, when he was talking in New York 2014, he was talking like Father Christmas, referring to Charles Dickens' novel, A Christmas Carol. So he said, ghosts of Christmas past, present, and yet to come, to lift their spirits up. So he's assuming the persona of Father Christmas, bringing toys to these financiers. Now, of course, when they talk, they use metaphors. But what we see here is this continuation of this. So it's not accidental. You know, there's a pattern. And then Fisher, he's one of the central bankers, because in the U.S. there are 12 states, and each state has its own central bank. And this guy is he writes very interesting, this Fisher guy. He says, this is about how the Federal Reserve will leave the quantitative easing. He said, there's no Alexander, so this is about the Gordian knot. Says, instead, when the right time comes, we must carefully remove the program's pulping and gingerly unwind it so as not to prompt market haywire. This is not a scientist talking. It's so they have powers to stop quantitative easing without creating big problems. Okay. So as I mentioned before, so we have now legal cases. I talk about the legal case in Europe, but there's also a legal case in the U.S. AIG shareholders took Federal Reserve to the courts when they bailed out AIG. They said they shouldn't have done it. They didn't pay the right price. So the court in the US found Federal Reserve guilty of doing that, but then said, I'm not going to give you compensation to AIG, because if Federal Reserve didn't save you, you would have lost everything. At least now you had something. Yeah? So we have two court cases challenging the lawfulness of these unconventional policies. Yeah? So that's the temptation then look at these as vigilantes rather than lawful behavior. And then you see, again, when you look at the financial media, there are others like this. Seth Klarman, he's a hedge fund manager. He says, we must question the morality of Fed programs. Morality. Yeah? Not the accurateness, but the morality. So I looked at the academic literature on vigilantism. Is there a social theory, political theory of vigilantes? I came across two interesting findings. One of them is the, like this Keller. He used the concept of vigilante to look at the law in the U.S. And there's La Palombara. He looked at vigilante to look at the magistrates in the... So there are very few social scientists trying to have a social theory of vigilante. So I need to do more work. I mean, there are, like Picard et al. In 2014, they use a superhero metaphor to study the accountants, how accountants' representation changed from boring people to consultants with superhero powers to save companies. And also, we have bond vigilantes, and they are real. So you can go to that website. So these are fund managers with serious banks. ING is a serious bank. Yeah, it's a serious bank, Dutch bank. And they have a website called Bond Vigilantes. Now what they say is, we attack countries like Greece, yeah, or Ireland. So those countries, they can't manage their fiscal deficit. So as bond vigilantes in the bond markets, we punish them by short-selling their bonds. Yeah? So there is this idea. And in a way, most of quantitative easing involves using the bond market. Yeah? And then there is a hedge fund research firm called Gotham City Research. And they punish companies with bad governance, like Volkswagen. Yeah. So that's their name. So we see, I mean, this is in financialized capitalism, what I'm trying to get here is increasingly the cultural representation of motives, actors, and then behaviors. Okay. And then in Ireland, Monaghan is a sociologist. In Ireland, there were silver vigilantes. So there's a group of NGO says, we want to punish banks. How do we punish them? We'll withdraw our money from banks, and with the same money, we'll buy silver. So we keep our wealth, but the banks will be punished because when we draw money, they'll collapse, but we won't lose our wealth. Okay? So this idea of vigilante is in financial markets, in financialized capitalism. Yeah? Gotham City Research, bond vigilantes, silver vigilantes. So I quite like when I started my research, I didn't know whether there was a dig, and then, you know, but again, I need to work. So the question with central bankers is, are they like Batman, savior or menace? Yeah. Because in Germany, people think it is a menace. It's going to create inflation. But then when you talk to the Italians or the French, they are savers. They save euro. Now, again, let's look at some numbers. So the way, I mean, cultural political economy is not just rhetorical. So the way I work, I also dig out data. Yeah? So this data shows they are savers because what they've done through quantum easing, they saved the governments pay less interest on servicing debt. So US government saved between 2007 and 2012, $1 trillion. Because quantum easing means less interest, so the US government spends less on servicing debt. Now, that's good for people as well. That means then the US government didn't have to cut $1 trillion from social welfare. Okay? So ordinary people benefited from central bank quantum easing as well. Now, in the Eurozone, it was 3.8% of the GDP. In the UK, it was 7% of the GDP. Yeah? So that's why the policies are not being criticized by general public and the politicians. But also, because they keep the interest rates low, in countries where people have high debt, they pay less interest, especially in the US and the UK, so they have more money to spend on other things. So there's a Keynesian demand creation through keeping interest rates low in those countries where you have high debt. So this is the measure of it. So as a result, in the US, the wealth effect is 5.6 trillion, but then you estimate how much of that wealth effect turns into actual consumption, yeah, in your GDP. Yeah, you have C plus I. So C goes up by 167 billion, which is 1% of GDP, which is not a small figure. Okay. So there's helping governments to pay less interest, and the budget deficits are managed better, but also creating Keynesian increase in consumption. Is it menace? It is menace because like Bank for International Settlement, IMF, OECD recently, they say the central bank policies are creating instability in financial markets. Yeah? Creating new instabilities. So this is the macroeconomic model in the simplest term. Yeah. So this is what they have in their mind. And as you can see, it is all Keynesian demand creation, but financial markets almost non-existent. So IMF finds, oh, we forgot something. The real economy side, but increasingly people are taking more financial risk. That's why the policies are not generating growth as expected, and that's why we see these volatility. So this is my calculation. The quantitative easing lifted the stock markets, but the investments as a percentage of GDP, both in the UK and the US, are still 20% less than. So investments are not increasing. Quantitative easing is creating financial bubbles. And in financialized capitalism, the money, the increase in stock market turns into mergers and acquisitions and share buybacks. Because in financialized capitalism, the firm behavior is about influencing your share price. Now again, that's something macroeconomists cannot comprehend. In macroeconomics, firms are profit-maximizing entrepreneurs. Whereas what the financialization literature looked at is, no, in modern financialized capitalism, firms are not competing in the goods market, they are competing in the stock market. It is generating high share price. So if you look at Siemens, its annual report, they say, we want to increase shareholder value. We want to increase our share price. So low interest rates, what this shows is this is before the crisis. So companies were borrowing money. Now it starts from zero because this is the dot-com crisis. Yeah. So this is one conjuncture after the dot-com crisis. So the new issues, companies issue bonds. And again, this was a low interest rate period, and they were buying shares. But they were buying shares more than what they issued in bonds. But after the crisis, it is more or less equal. I.e., companies issue bonds not to invest in factories, as these models think, yeah? Instead, they borrow money to buy back shares, because when you buy back your share price goes up. When your share price goes up, most CEOs get bigger bonuses. And the central bank macroeconomic models don't have this. And it's only recently OECD has written a report, oh, this model is not working. That's why IMF, we have all these things are happening now. Yeah, money goes to emerging markets for speculative purposes, searching for high yield. It creates currency volatility, and then it hurts life insurance, etc. Yeah, but IMF's model ignores this aspect as well. So companies use cheap money. Remember, we start with the picture of central banks printing money, keeping interest rates low. And those low interest rates should have created new investments. Companies are not investing. What they do, they borrow money at low interest rates to buy their shares back to increase their share price. And that's financialization, financialized capitalism. And these are the statistics. And this is, again, this is not my research. This is Bank for International Settlements research. So the mainstream international financial organizations are becoming concerned that the money is not. So my guess, with ECB starting quantitative easing, you will see more mergers and acquisitions in Europe. In fact, we've started to see Spanish companies issuing IPOs. Because quantitative easing means high stock market. With high stock market, companies want to make money rather than invest. Investing is long. And companies don't believe that we are out of the problem. Right, okay. So What does it mean then if I want to politically interfere? Yeah? Now, this analysis is important. So we need a new governance mechanism to control and make central banks accountable, and it's not being politically debated. How? We need to bring these economic models the central banks use under scrutiny. You can do it in various ways, but at the moment they're not being scrutinized. But it should be a political demand that they should be scrutinized. And they should be scrutinized by independent democratic committees. And my guess is you can put academics in it, market economists in it, from pension funds, because pension funds and insurance companies suffer from these policies. You can also put the unions, NGOs. Yeah. So we need to create that kind of a committee that will scrutinize those macroeconomic models of central banks. And also, we need to, they provide reports, but those reports do not show things like the qualitative aspect of job creation. Because the US says the quantitative easing worked in the US because the unemployment rate has come down. But when we look at the US, why unemployment has come down, it is low wage jobs it is being created. And also when you look at labor participation, there's a large number of people who've given up looking for jobs, so they're not included in the unemployment statistics. So the quality of job creation in the US is poor. It's not creating high wage jobs, and a large number of people left the job market. In the UK, it is not creating it is not creating productivity. Productivity got worse. I mean, the anecdotal evidence is people say, "I am not unemployed. I become self-employed," because on your CV it looks better if you put between 2007 and 2012 I was self-employed. There's anecdotal evidence, but also statistical evidence that people lose their jobs, but then they become decorators, plumbers. They don't do anything, but on their CV, it looks like they're self-employed. So we need better reporting to show the quality of growth and quality of job creation. And also data about bubbles, stock markets. Yeah, we need more sophisticated reporting of they only report inflation rate, unemployment rate, without going into details. And also, we need to de-conglomerate the monetary policy. At the moment, European Central Bank supervises banks, so they are in charge of the banking union. They do stress testing of banks. They do quantitative easing. So there are lots of conflict of interest if one institution does that. Okay? So we need to have different institutions, new public agencies dealing with the banking, dealing with the monetary side of things, dealing with the job creation. Okay? So the money goes to the right place. And that's all.